Continuing with chapter 3, text 1. The vow of studying the three Vedas under a teacher must be kept for 36 years, or for half that time, or for a quarter, or until the student has perfectly learnt them. So here, generally, studying the three Vedas, then before, as that was the very standard, the Rig, Yajur, and Sama Vedas were studied by those who were very serious about studying the Veda. Because originally there was one Veda, and that one Veda then dealt with, the one Veda dealt with everything. Then, when Vyasadeva saw it was very difficult for someone to accommodate everything very easily, he divided it up. So all of the hymns he put into one Veda, that is the Rig Veda, because the hymns are the Rigs, so it's known as the Rig Veda. Then the, all of the prose portions of the Veda, that was put together in the Yajur. And then the prayers, they were put together as the Sama. So the Rig Veda is used for, in the sacrifices, for installing the fire, for calling the deity, for establishing the deity. Then in the worship, then the Yajur is used for the worship. So all the technical rules of worship and everything are in the Yajur. And then the prayers, all the songs, they're in the Sama. Because the Sama then is sung. Means the Rig and the Yajur deal with three notes. The Swarita, Udata, and Anudata. Means the middle note, the upper, and the lower. While the Samaved deals with seven notes, all seven. Like that. And different ones will come out. So, how they use the scale, then you'll come out with all your different ragas and all your different, meters that are used in the singing, all comes out of the Samaved. So then one would study all three of these. And then the Atharva is miscellaneous things. You know, it's generally all social things. The medicine, the martial arts, all these different things, the various arts and all these kind of elements, they were all in the Atharva Veda. So if one studied all four, that was nice. But if not, the essence was in the three. Because that's where all the philosophy and the main activities were. So then it was not uncommon that one would study the three Vedas. So traditionally, a study of a Veda is 12 years. It doesn't take 12 years actually to memorize the Veda. But because the importance was on realizing the meaning of the Veda, therefore they stayed longer. So they would study a certain portion of the day. They would study in the morning and in the evening. Generally, the evening would begin with the twilight. They would come together. There would be chanting of mantras. Then there would be discussion of the philosophy and all that. That would be that aspect. And then in the morning would be the actual memorization of the Vedic texts. That would be when they would memorize. So some time was spent in the morning. Early morning was then collecting their firewood and these kind of activities, performance of the yajna, the japa, and all their sadhana was done early. Then after that, they memorized the mantras. After that, then there would be begging, and then the afternoons would be for self-study, work around the ashram, evening time work in the ashram, and then the study, then the philosophy. So this would be the normal thing. So you would be doing menial activities three times a day, in the morning, at noon, and in the evening. And there would be two times of class and one of study. So you put that together, that would be the education. So you could memorize probably much quicker than 12 years. You know, nowadays, if they're just those schools that just teach the Veda, then the Rig will be learned, I think, in 10 years. The Vyajra and Sama in 8, and the Atharva in 5 or 6 years, like that. The Sama has less shlokas. It has 1,000, I think, 200 or 300 verses. But because you're learning it in the ganapat, the singing, it's very complex. So what will take a few seconds to chant in the normal chanting, the kramapat, will take about 1 minute in the ganapat. So therefore it takes so much time. Yajurveda, I think, is around 8,000 shlokas. And the rig is around 10,000. And the Atharva is 5 or 6,000. So like that, they would deal. So 12 years was standard. So then the 3 Vedas, you give the 12 years. But then, if you're just learning the Veda itself, it doesn't take that long. You know, it can be done for less, especially if they're very quick. They don't have to repeat much. But the basic thing is that, so half the time means 36, so that means 18 years, or a quarter, 9 years, or until the student has perfectly learned them. So maybe less than that, more than that. But the idea is that the Brahmacharya says the vow of studying the Vedas is that one makes a vow. This is a very essential element, basically, in the Vedic culture, is that someone takes a vow that he's going to do something for a certain amount of time. Vow doesn't mean you go in front of the deities, this, that. It just means you make a determination. Like, let's say someone decides, okay, I join, because now we're going to go, this chapter is then dealing with householders, marriage, which will come up, is that the Brahmachari, he has taken a vow, okay, 12 years I'm going to be a Brahmachari, I'm going to practice Brahmacharya, and I'm going to study the Veda, perform menial service, try to gain and understand, realize the Vedic knowledge. After that time, then I'm going to get married. So he will not get married before that. He will wait until those 12 years are completed, and then he will get married. So in the same way, it's a very valuable instruction. Someone comes to the movement, they join, you know, and then they should take a certain amount of time, that for this amount of time, we're just going to be absorbed in the activities, brahmachari activities, book distribution, you know, washing pots or whatever it is that needs to be done. And then after that amount of time, then we'll consider marriage. Otherwise, then the mind is peaceful. Because the mind is always thinking, should I not, should I not. It's just a matter is that, okay, even if we accept, yes, we will, but let's give it this time. Because that's important. Some will say, according to some modern ideas, is that, well, if you're going to get married anyway, why not today? Why wait? I remember we used to use that on that theory on Sankirtan, is that after taking breakfast, you know, at 9 o'clock, then you pack your bags, book bags, and you jump on the bus, and they take you to the spot, then you fall asleep, though, you know, when somebody wakes you up, you say you're not asleep, and all these things. And then when you get to the spot, then you get out and you take your book box and all that and put it in a place, and then you think, okay, now what am I going to do? So very common was as well, we have our book distribution and we want to get on with that, but then we also have this lunch that they've given us. Now that's going to get in the way of our book distribution. So since we're going to eat later, we might as well eat now. And so you sit down, you eat all that, and then you get down to your book distribution. But it's not necessarily the best policy, you know. So the idea is that these moving from the one ashram to the other, there's preparation. It's a natural sequence. Prabhupada mentions a first-class brahmachari makes a first-class grihastha. Why? Because he has knowledge and he has controlled senses. If he has knowledge, he can actually see how things work. He can see, observe the material nature. He can observe himself. He can observe others. And if he is observant, he can give this to others. Otherwise, if he's not observant, how you'll give that to someone else? So if we don't contemplate, we're not inquisitive, how are we going to give that to the children? Not possible. So we take that time to develop that. The senses aren't controlled, then how will the house run properly? No one in the family will respect such a man because his senses aren't controlled. So when the senses are controlled, there's natural respect. The children respect, the wife respects, other members of the family respect, other grihasthas respect. This is a, you know, very nice, upstanding grihastha, and they do things very nicely. And the whole, therefore you can develop the family, the community, you know, the temple, everything can develop nicely. Because unless the senses are controlled, nothing in this world can be attained. There's nothing that can be obtained. No, even just a mundane art cannot be mastered if one's senses are not controlled. Because you have to give the time. So this is very important that a vow is taken. That's why it mentions this here, that it's known in your mind, I'm going to the Gurukul for this much time. So it's either I go for the full 36 years for training in the three Vedas, or I go for half of that, or a quarter of that, or I stay until I've learned them. I learn it in 1 year, fine. I learn it in 50 years, fine. Whatever it is, I stay that. So there's a determination. And that fixed, that one-pointed fixed determination then is very useful. Because Krishna points out is that those who have a fixed mind, they actually can get somewhere. And if we don't have a fixed mind, very difficult. So it's a very important element that is there. That one makes a decision and then goes on with that. Someone mentioned to me once, Prabhupada said that in the Gurukul, when the students are reach 20, then you can ask them if they are planning to get married or not. Because generally by 20 they have a pretty good idea. You know, if they've grown up in the system, they have an idea. And if they do, then arrangements and these can start to be made. But the vow of brahmacharya continues till they're 25. Then at 25 they graduate and then they can go and then they get married. So this is the tradition. So we see it here that Manu is presenting this point. And we see that Prabhupada, that was the original points that he's giving us. So it's a very, very important point here. And two, a student who has studied in due order the three Vedas, or two or even one only, without breaking the rules of studentship, shall enter the order of householders. Means he has studied properly in the proper way, and without breaking the rules of studentship, means he's behaved as a proper student. He now is allowed, qualified to become a grihastha. Generally we take, you know, the person who's totally uncontrolled senses, completely madhouse, they're, you know, good grihastha material. But actually in the Vedic culture it's not accepted, because then that's the kind of child you get. Someone is very lusty, they get married. If they conceive a child, what is the whole focus of attention? Lust. So now, what will be the consciousness of that child? Lust. So then when the child grows up and we can't figure out why, I mean, the devotee's children, like that and that, why they're so lusty, why they're so, you know, interested in the girls, and they're interested in drugs, and they're interested in this and that, and they don't want to do menial service, don't care to chant Hare Krishna, don't care for this or that. Then one has to look back on oneself. What was our consciousness at the time of conception? So it's a very, very important element. And the Western culture likes to kind of like finesse these things. You know, it's like, you know, you can watch sex on television, you know, all the movies, everything's like this. You know, you advertise everything with sex, but when it comes down to it, then that's you don't talk about. Vedic culture is just the opposite. None of this is discussed. You know, you don't advertise, do advertisement with women. You don't show women doing this and that, and you don't show all these things. But conception, you know, planning for conception, all this is very open. Very open. Because it's like you want a proper child. So that has to be discussed. Husband and wife have to discuss what is the child you want. Right? It's a very interesting phenomena, because the mind, you know, has attachments for these things. We've been dealing with eating, sleeping, mating, defending since time immemorial. So, you know, mating is a very, you know, it's one of the I mean, out of the four, it's probably, you know, number one. You know, it's like the most popular of all these things. So then, how do you deal with that? Because if it's only reduced to the moment of conception, and that's it, then so much pent-up interest has to be dealt with in that moment. And so then that makes for a very dodgy child. You don't really know what you're going to get, because your mind may be anywhere. So the whole idea in the Vedic thing is this: no, you fix your mind, you know exactly what you're going for at that moment. So then you have the husband and wife discuss, what is this child? What child? What kind of child? What is the nature, qualities? What kind of activities? Then, right, there, it's a very nice open thing. I mean, it's not a strange thing. It's just, what kind of child would you like? You know, you ask the father, what kind of son would you like? And he would naturally say, I want these qualities. And you ask the mother, what kind of son would you like? Oh, these qualities. So then they work out and come to something where they agree on the same child. Right? Otherwise, if the father's thinking one child, mother's thinking another, then what does that make as far as the personality goes? You know? You have a child who can't figure himself out, has no real identity. So this way, the child has a singular identity because the parents have, this is what they're thinking of. So that in itself also relieves so much of lust and these kind of things, that very openly these things are being discussed. So all this kind of like pent up, you know, giggly lust gets released. Then, okay, now we want this child. Now, when is the proper time? So then one has to work out what are auspicious times, you know, means as far as date, months, seasons, months, dates, times of the day, and all this is planned. So that in itself is also, it's a bona fide way to talk about sex, but it's in a very regulated way. Then we know, okay, this is the time, and then everything is planned for that. It's very open. These kind of things they can be very open. You know, it's like Prabhupada mentions that before, sometimes it was announced that at this time, you know, that the king or that and the queen were going to try to conceive the prince. And everybody was thinking, oh yes, very auspicious time. You know, they look at the time, this is very good, yes, this time will... Because the birth chart, the Janma Kundali can be made off of the conception. In fact, many times in the Vedic, that's the main element. So if you can't get that, then you go by the birth. And if you can't get that, then you have all kinds of systems to try to find it out. But the moment of conception is also would be known. We would think, well, how, you know, you think back, you know, you had a kid, how do you know what time? Because your voice is planned. You know, on this day, you know, between 10:30 and 11, that's the auspicious time. So then you know that's the time. Then you can make a chart on that. You know what kind of child. You can make the chart beforehand. You can pick the time. Look, make the chart. What will this give? What kind of child will that give? You know? And they say, yes, we know we wanted this kind of a Brahminical kid. And they go, well, because the son's over here, he's going to have more of a Kshatriya nature and all that. Then how to get that? Well, this next time, then the son will be here. Then that will make... So it looks very long and drawn out, but then you get what you pay for. You know? I mean, you're going to have to live with the kid for the next, you know, 20 years, so you might as well get what you want. You know? So, you know, some planning is worth it. So this is why Krishna says sex according to religious principles means in this way, that is Krishna. Because we see the whole aspect of lust has basically been cut out. It's been cut out. And everything's planned, and how is it planned? According to Krishna's rules. So we're looking for godly qualities, devotional qualities. We're looking for proper times that Krishna says. We're following the samskars that Krishna says, Garbhodan. And then, so then everything is in line with Krishna's instructions. So therefore, this is called, this is called dharma. And this is the mentality, so you can see it's a very different mentality. It's not that just husband and wife feel like it and then they have a kid. Or so many times, I mean, I've heard it, you know, hundreds of times. It's like, you know, the kid saying, well, actually, I wasn't planned. You know, they didn't actually want to have me. But, you know, they just decided it was, you know, more nice to not have an abortion. And so then they exist. So, I mean, that's not a great, thing for a kid to feel. So immediately you start off, you've already created the neurotic kid. Because it wasn't planned in the first place. Just lust is there. Or you just decide like that. But then what is it based on? So if lust is the cause, that's Kandarpa. So Krishna says, of causes of procreation, I am Kandarpa. I am Cupid. I am lust. But he says causes, but he doesn't say that sex is Krishna. No, he says the one that's planned, that is Krishna. So it's Krishna mentions both. So Krishna is so kind. Eating, he gives all the rules for eating. Sleeping, you know, you put your head to the east or to the south, and so many things. Don't go to bed with wet feet. Don't have oil in your body. Mating, so many rules. Bhagavatam talks about it very clearly. I mean, conception of diti and pregnancy of diti in the evening. I mean, the whole thing of there. I mean, that's so clear. The wife was so worried that her co-wife, Aditi, already had a child. She didn't. So therefore, Aditi was like in a better position than her. So she was totally interested in prestige. You know? Prestige, wealth, all these things. And so she approaches the husband. Husband is, you know, it's twilight. He's doing his meditation. And she comes and says, you know, I want a child. And then he says, just wait. This muhurta is bad. Lord Shiva is moving with his ghosts. And that, and you wait. A muhurta is 24 minutes long. 24 minutes. She would not wait 24 minutes. So then, she just uses her natural talents and attracts the mind of her husband, and child is conceived. So it's all happening within that time, at 24 minutes. Right. So now he's attracted by lust, she's attracted by position and wealth and all this, and then what is their kid? Hiranya Kashipu. Wealth and soft bed. Right. So they got exactly what they paid for. Yeah. Perfect, you know, it was perfect. Like that. Now then, question may come up. Someone will say, well, what about Prahlad? That's an interesting story. You heard this guy?
Yeah.
No. So, when Hiranyakashipu and Hiranyaksha went out for the first time to do their meditation, then they went to the forest and started their tapasya. And the demigods got very worried because here are the biggest demons. And now they're doing tapasya to become bigger demons. So they're very worried what to do. So they were all discussing amongst themselves and very much in anxiety. So then Narad Muni says, don't worry, I'll take care of it. So then he and I think Parvata Muni, then they went down to the place where they were performing their tapasya, and they took the forms of sparrows. Right? You know sparrow?
Yeah.
Little birds like this, common birds. Very annoying chirp. You know? So they went and they found a tree that was very close, I mean very close to where Hiranyakashipu was, but a little out of reach, but very close. And they went, sat down, you know, preened themselves a little bit, you know, sat nicely. And then at the top of their little screechy sparrow voices started chanting Om Namo Narayanaya. So then this broke Hiranyakashipu's meditation. Right? Then there's these little birds, you know, he tries to shoo them away, you know, moves his hand and, you know, does things like that, and they just move a little down on the branch, and then you know, he's satisfied, and then they start chanting loudly again. So then he becomes angry, and he picks up his bow and arrow, shoots at them, and they fly off and all this. And now his meditation is totally broken, and he's totally upset. So then he decides, okay, we'll go back to the palace and, you know, calm down, and then we'll come back for this, you know, our meditation. So then they go to the palace, back to the palace. Everyone's a little surprised to see him back so quick, but whatever. And then they decide that, you know, after this very terrible experience of hearing the Lord's name, you know, we have to forget this. So they absorb themselves in, you know, jollying and, hearing music and eating and being with friends and laughing and joking and all these things. But nothing will make this experience go from his mind. Like that. So then after, you know, the evening and all that with the friends, then he decides, okay, there's one thing, you know, everyone forgets everything about. You know, he'll go and associate with his wife. So then he was doing that, and then at the moment of conception, he was still thinking of this bird chanting God's name. So in his mind, just Om Namo Narayanai, Om Namo Narayanai was going through his head, and he was thinking of this bird who happened to be Narad Muni. So he's thinking of the pure devotee and chanting the Lord's name. And therefore, he conceived Prahlad. So, it works. That's the system. You think of whatever you're thinking of, that is what you get. Therefore, the Vedic culture was, we can't be so assured that we're going to be that absorbed, we're going to be that demoniac by hearing the Lord's holy name, we're going to be so absorbed that at the time of conception we're going to have a pure devotee. So it's recommended that one plans all these things, you know, that one takes the trouble. So the student has to be able, if he can't make a vow that in this line, how is he going to keep this? So how will be a good grihastha? You decide, okay, we've done all this, and we decide, and then after 3 months, or there's this very nice time, how are you going to wait 3 months? Right? How one will wait? Because the mind will be totally absorbed in this. Right? So in the Vedic culture, it's saying in the Bhagavatam that when the fertility time of the wife comes, then the man is starting to go all funny. But that's just that's within the last few days. It doesn't say he's going all weird for the last so many months. So this means because of planning, because of self-control, because of this vow of brahmacharya. They've taken this vow, they've successfully finished the vow, then they graduate. So that's glorious. So that is the next point coming here, is the snatak. Therefore, the snatak is respected. If there's a king and there's a snatak on the road, the king moves out of the way for the snataka. Because the snataka is the brahmachari who's finished his vow. He's taken the vow, he's finished it. Therefore, in society, he is the most glorious. Of course, in the previous verses, it pointed out at the conclusion of the chapter, that brahmachari who keeps lifelong, naistika brahmachari, he's the most glorious. But he's not glorious socially. Because he doesn't move in the society. He stays in the ashram, he just goes back to Godhead. But those who move in the society, then the snatak, he is the brahmachari, he's gone through, he's finished his vow, and now, you know, he is, you know, doing further study, and then he'll get married and then take up his activities. So then, three. He who is famous for the strict performance of his duties and has received his heritage, the Veda, from his father, shall be honored, sitting on a couch and adorned with a garland, with a present of a cow and the honey mixture, which means Madhuparka. Yeah, so this means he will be honored sitting on a couch and adorned with a garland and the present of a cow and the honey mixture. This is the this is the beginning stages of the rites of marriage. That the first thing that happens in marriage is that the groom comes and the father of the girl seats him nicely, gives him a place to sit, kusasan and all that. So many mantras are exchanged. Cow is given. And Madhuparka. The ceremony is called Madhuparka. And how do you say? That respect is there. Because the father says, now I have chosen you as the suitable groom for the girl. Because now we must look at this. That we may look at that, well, what's the big deal? It's a marriage. Now you look at. Now, someone who has gone through all this trouble, they themselves have been trained. They have, you know, properly conceived the child with the proper understandings, proper motives. Then someone has a daughter. Then that daughter is very dear to the father. Like that. The sons are very dear to the mother. The daughter is very dear to the father. So the father is the shelter of this girl. And the girl sees the father very much as a shelter. So she's totally dependent. So now with all this care, and he's gone through this all time, training the daughter, protecting the daughter, his wife is training the daughter so nicely in all the technicalities of household activities. Then, he's after all this trouble, he's not just going to hand his daughter over to just anybody. He wants to see that she will get the proper facility, care, respect that she's gotten in her own house. Therefore, after studying and seeing the character of the boy, the father now is handing the daughter over to this boy. So it's a very great moment. It's a very significant, it's more significant, this part of it, to the father than it is to the groom. Groom is just happy he's getting married and that the girl is suitable. Because also from his side, they've gone to see that there. So he's not involved so much. The parents are very happy of the boy that now, after he's grown up and all that, they found a very suitable girl. They're happy. And the husband, or the father of the girl is very happy. So they're the ones that are actually the ones, you know, that are in ecstasy here. The boy and girl are a little bit, you know, it's all happening a little too fast, you know, for them. But it's a very significant moment in the life of the father to give the daughter to the future husband. Therefore, here the father is coming, receiving him, worshiping him, because now the daughter has been under his care, and as a kanya, as an unmarried girl, the demigods reside in her body. There's, I think, seven or six demigods who reside in the body of an unmarried girl. Then that means unmarried means, according to the Vedic standards, means she hasn't been touched, like that. Means so they there and they protect her. You know, therefore they're considered, they're so powerful, and they're so pure because also these demigods are residing within their body. So then now he worships that this boy is now going to take over those duties of him and those demigods. So the father is receiving him very nice. So when it says here he will be honored, and it's pointing out here is that it's a very great thing, because it is. Like that. Modern is not so much. Father walks the, you know, girl up the aisle. There's significance. He's very happy in all this. But here it's like it's even more, the detail is coming out. Here is just he's giving the how you say, before the kanyadan, before the girl is given to the boy, then the groom is worshipped by the father. You know, with proper place to sit, with cows and with a garland. Because that is given by, because the girl will come with a garland, and then the next thing in the marriage is then the girl comes, circumambulates the boy, and they exchange garlands. Like that. So that garland has been given by her, the girl's own father. You know? And the other garland has been put on her by all her close friends. So these are very significant things if we understand what's going on in the culture, what is the depth of what's actually happening. Then we can see that it's, you know, everything, every little bit has been thought out because Krishna's made it. So Krishna is the most thoughtful. So what he creates is the most wonderful. But we have to understand what's there. Just like you give a very valuable, gem to a small child, the child does not appreciate it. It's just something you play with and throw around and put in your mouth and put in your pocket and put on the side. But if you show that to a gem collector, you know, they'll be amazed. You know, what a wonderful gem. So it's a matter of qualification. We may say, well, you know, we've heard what Prabhupada says about all these things, and well, you know, we've kind of tried to follow it, but it didn't seem to work. So, you know, then the idea is we just, you know, it doesn't work in this age, or we throw it out. You know, it's amazing, everything else seems to work in this age of Krishna's creation. Fire still burns, you know, water's still wet, you know, like that. Air still carries aroma, you know. It's like the sense of touch is there, hearing is there, smell is there. Everything is there. Somehow or another we figure Krishna's culture won't work. Right? You know, the philosophy somehow or another works. He spoke Bhagavad Gita 5,000 years ago. It's still good today. But these same shastras that were written down about how to... Gita says, perform your prescribed duties. The book's written down at the same time how to perform the prescribed duties. They're no good anymore. So, but that doesn't make sense. Otherwise, why would Prabhupada talk about it? Why would he talk about proper behavior between husband and wife, what is the relationship, parent and child, leaders and followers? Why would he talk about these things? Unless they meant something. So we have to educate ourselves both in understanding it, knowing what it is, knowing how to apply it, and then applying it. When we do this, then we become happy. Then things will work for us. Otherwise, we'll be frustrated. We'll always be frustrated. Then, text 4. Having bathed with the permission of his teacher and performed according to the rule of a samvartana, the rite of returning home, twice-born man shall marry a wife of equal caste who is endowed with auspicious bodily marks. So having bathed means the snataka, means that he's in samvartana ceremony. Now he's been taking help from the upanayanam ceremony, means that he's received the cloth. The cloth he wears, that is the belt. Excuse me. First is the belt that he wears. The belt is considered the consort of the Lord, who is like a sister, who protects him, you know, keeps him chaste, keeps him pure, like that. Then he has, that belt is, I mean, we put it on the painting of Vamana Day, we put it outside his cloth, just as a belt, like you hold up your pants. It's the belt that you hang your kopins on, like that, and that protects you. So the belt, the outside, that is installed in the brahmachari. It goes around the waist, not the portion in the front. The sannyasi's, the portion in the front is installed. So that you only have Lord's potency in the belt. So then in that belt, that protects his purity, his chastity. And he respects that belt. And he makes prayer that I will not offend this belt by improper behavior. Then his cloth, then he has the deer skin or the cloth, this upper cloth, his chadar. That is the effulgence of the sun, which gives all, you know, strength, valor, and purity, and all these different aspects that are needed for his studies. Then he has the staff, the brahmachari stick. This is knowledge. He has the thread, which is the rite for sacrifice. So he's taking help of all these different personalities and energies of the Lord. So now he's going to leave the brahmachari ashram. So then all these things are again gained, but now through different mediums. Now the shoes, now he starts wearing shoes, meaning before he would go barefoot, now he wears, no, they'll wear leather shoes or they'll wear some fancy shoes. He's not, and so these shoes are now his eyes, which will direct him. So this replaces, you know, the different aspects. And then he's bathed with the water. That water is now his protection. Before he had the belt, now he has the water that protects him. So these different aspects are there that do the same aspects, but now for a grihastha. So he transfers from one aspect of protection to another aspect. And then he is bathed. So with the water, then he is sprinkled with this water. And the teacher washes his feet, you know, out of respect, because here is someone who has finished his vow. He has studied the Veda. He has learned it nicely. He has performed his brahmachari training nicely. So even the teacher is respecting the qualities of such a person. And then after that, then he leaves the ashram of the teacher, and then he goes out. And then it mentions you should marry a girl of equal caste who is endowed with auspicious bodily marks. So this is, in other words, there should be a similar nature. Because if there's not a similar nature, then all the simple things in life are going to drive each other nuts. Because marriages fall apart not for big things, but for small things. You know, little things. So one has to have a similar nature, that these little things are similar. Like that. Very important element. Like that, that is missed when we simply depend upon Gandharva rites, which is the modern marriage, basically. It means, you know, mutual consent between a boy and girl. They're married. That's the Gandharva rites. They exchange garland, exchange a ring, and you're married. You know? That's all it is, right? This is the Gandharva rites. So now the problem comes is that when there is association of the boy and girl before marriage, then they are both super sensitive to each other. Generally, if there's anywhere close to a ballpark, you know, match, you know, anything this side of the moon, then there's some sensitivity. At every moment, they're walking down the path, then they both can see that what's coming up is it's a little bit smaller, like that. Immediately they're all thinking, who's going to go through first? How that will be done? Will I say something? Or will who? You know, it's a total trip. And it's all in the sensitivity. Everything, a little movement, and the other one is thinking, what's going on? Did I do something wrong, say something wrong? What do they want? So because of that absolute sensitivity, they think everything is going to be perfect. But they actually have not actually found out what is each other's nature. What does the boy like to do? What does the girl actually like to do? What are they thinking about? What is their plans? You know, what is their values of wealth? How they're going to live? Are they living in a temple? Are they living outside? How much are they involved in the temple? Are they full-time devotees, part-time devotees, you know, occasional devotees? Do they have to become very wealthy? Are they going to be satisfied with something simple? You know, are they having children, not having children? If so, how many children? How are these children going to be educated? Are they going to go to karmic school? They're going to go to, you know, devotee school? You know, so many things. Anyone talks that things? No. Why? They're too embarrassing. I mean, you can't even work out just pleasantly how to sit down on a bench together, let alone how to with these points. So then how is it going to happen? Therefore, we would see that the arranged marriage was there. Somebody who knows the boy talks with somebody who knows the girl, and they see if the natures are similar. Because it's very easy for fathers and mothers and mothers-in-laws and all these things to find out just what the other people are at, where they're at, you know? Mother-in-law invites the girl over, they come, they see, ask her to join her in the kitchen, wash some pots. After the girl's finished washing the pot, she picks up the spoon or the pot, looks in the place where it's always going to be dirty unless you really know what you're doing cleaning. She looks at it. If there's dirt there, marriage is off. She knows these aren't up to the standard of cleanliness. But if there are families that don't look for this, then you don't have to worry. But if one family is into very simple, clean, another family is not, then it's already worked that you know. The boy has grown up in a super clean house. He's not going to appreciate marrying a girl who's not, or vice versa. So they've already, these things are seen. Then at the last, then the boy and girl see if they like each other. So it's very scientific. Because this Gandharva rites actually don't make for great marriages. If they did, we wouldn't be looking at, you know, 75% divorce rate in most of your developed countries, because it fails. Because it doesn't afford. You don't know who you're marrying. Like that, you know. The day it comes, generally within the first 6 months of the marriage, one morning one wakes up, and then one has the, you know, it strikes one. Who did I marry? You know, and it appears to be someone different than that used to sit very, you know, carefully and sensitively on the bench with. You know, it seems to be something totally different because we never dealt with actually the individual. You know? Like that. We were only dealing with a few glances, a few touches, a few giggles, a few smiles, you know, a little this or that. Or, you know, nowadays reading a little from the Bhagavatam, the chapter on, you know, ideal household life. You know, something like that. It gives an opportunity to break the ice, but it doesn't actually, it's not complete. So the Vedic culture was very interested to see that these things, that there was equal nature. Because you're talking 50-50. Husband and wife, swakya means equal. It means that there's equality there. 50-50. So there has to be that the 50 you give away has to be a 50% that the other one person wants to take. Otherwise, how it'll function? Is this okay? We're not getting too over the top here?
Good.
Okay. So we make sure we're not, no one's getting too upset here. So this is the thing, one is looking for very much equality, like that. Though the relationship always is going to be that mutual respect, the wife's going to respect the husband's going to be very sensitive to the wife's needs, all these things. So now, these things can only happen that the husband, see, the boy must be trained in brahmacharya and how to be sensitive to the needs of the woman. So he's sensitive to the needs of the mother, the wife, the daughter. So that only comes is, how does it come? Someone's a lusty brahmacharya and can't hold it together, you know, can't serve nicely and all this. They're sensitive. They're sensitive to their own needs, but to others? No. So they do menial service, then they are sensitive to the need, the desire of the teacher. What is the teacher's mood? Right? That's the thing that they have to imbibe from the teacher, is what is his mood? So they must be sensitive to that. Prabhupada says, first-class disciple means one who already understands the mood of the guru and does what he's supposed to do before he's asked. Right? Second, he's told what to do, he does it. Third, he's told, you know, he still doesn't necessarily do it. So first, already understands the mood and does it. So now, that person, as a married man, will be sensitive to the needs of the wife, the daughter, you know, the mother, all these things. Otherwise, how he'll be? Because this is sensitivity out of duty. Anybody can be sensitive sitting on the bench with the girl you just met. You know, because you don't want to blow it. Now, who's going to be sensitive after marriage? Because of duty. So that's only someone who's been trained very nicely as a brahmachari. Otherwise it's not going to happen. How will it happen? That's why Prabhupada says first class brahmachari makes first class grihastha. And then the girl likewise is trained in chastity and to be satisfied with whatever the father, the husband, or the son can provide. Because everyone has their nature. And a man, for X amount of work, gets X amount of return. And that's it. Somebody works 8 hours a day, makes millions of dollars. Right? What is it? Bill Gates, $30 million a day. Right? Maybe he works more than 8 hours. Maybe he puts in 16. But even we divide that in half, 15 million in 8 hours. Not bad. Not bad. Right? But someone else is working 8 hours and he's pulling in, you know, 40 rupees. So the point is that's all they can pull in. And if the wife is not satisfied with that, or the daughter is not satisfied with that, or the mother is not satisfied with that, then there cannot be peace in the family. Because then what does it mean? The time that you would spend for spiritual life, the time that you would spend for with the family, you have to spend to try to gain more economic wealth. So then what happens to spiritual life? Finish. So Vedic culture is for spiritual upliftment. Therefore, if there's no satisfaction, it won't work. Therefore, must marry someone equal. You have rich desires, marry someone who's naturally rich. You are satisfied simply, then marry someone who's simple. Like that. You are sophisticated, marry someone sophisticated. Otherwise, it won't work. These things are what drive you nuts. Emotions happen not on the gross platform. They happen on the subtle platform. They're mind. And mind is what the mind likes. You get it, you're happy. You don't get it, you're not happy. So the same desires are not there in every living entity. It means the conditioning is different. So you have to find someone with a similar conditioned nature. Then both of you have a common platform to work on. Husband has certain attachments, wife has the same attachments. So together they work to overcome those attachments and become detached from the material world and go back to Godhead. If wife has one set and the man has another set, then, you know, it's a bit much to work on. Because she wants to work on hers and he wants to work on his, and then, you know, what's the commonality? You know? So therefore, the untrained brahmachari, the untrained girl, then sex will be the natural binding factor. And Prabhupada says, and when that's not happening nicely, then there's divorce. So that in no way satisfies anyone. And the Vedic culture completely removes itself from that, avoids that. Means it just stays away from this. Like that. So it's therefore the boy has to be qualified, the girl has to be qualified. Then you get very good results. The house is very peaceful, the wife is satisfied, then she's like Lakshmi, and all prosperity is there in the house. And it mentions that, Prabhupada quotes that, is that if the wife is very satisfied and very dutiful and performs, you know, her whatever her activities are nicely, then the whole family becomes prosperous. Not even just the husband and wife and their immediate, but also all the relatives and everything. That's why they would be so careful. A girl is coming into your family. The girl leaves her family, comes into the boy's family. That girl is good. That whole family prospers. Everyone, all the relatives, because she's like Lakshmi. She comes empowered with that potency of Lakshmi. Just her wonderful qualities and her pleasantness and the motherly attitude and the service and all that, everybody is so happy and satisfied that everything prospers. The husband is very peaceful and satisfied. He goes out, he does everything very nicely. Prosperity comes. He is very unsatisfied and very disturbed. He goes out, very hard to bring anything back. Prosperity goes. So this subtle platform is the most essential element. And it says if the girl is bad, she can destroy the whole family. Because then everybody's mind becomes disturbed. Husband's mind is disturbed, he's going to complain naturally to his parents and his other brothers and sisters, and they're going to be disturbed, and this and that, until the whole family gets disturbed. So it's a very... So the subtleties are the essential element. The Vedic culture works on the platform of the subtlety, is how to conquer the mind and engage it in the Lord's service. And the mind's connected to the senses, and it can be controlled by the intelligence, so you take that whole package, that's called and the ego is there. So that's called the conditioned nature. But the central pivot is the mind. Like that. You catch the mind, then you have the whole thing. So the mind means the emotions. So if the emotions are properly engaged, then success is there. But it can only be engaged properly if we're trained properly. Like that. Or we have to educate ourselves and then overcome what are the obstacles due to lack of training. Because the point is the brahmachari didn't have this, or the girl didn't have these qualities when they were young. They were trained in them. So when you're trained when you're young, it's easy, right? It's, you know, a young bamboo you can bend, an old bamboo very hard. So the point is you when you get older, by one's intelligence, by one's determination, by the power of the holy name, one can overcome that conditioned nature and properly situate oneself. So, but it just makes it easier if from the beginning it's like that. So as, you know, as first generation, we may not have that opportunity, but we can try to arrange that seed the second generation. And that second generation will be partially associated with us and partially really well trained. So then their children, they're the ones we're looking for. Prabhupada said, our children's children, they'll be the pujaris. They'll be the, you know, the real preachers. You know, they'll light fire by mantra. I even heard some devotees say they'll fly on, they can fly on carpets. Whatever. It's the same principle. They have the purity, the determination, and the qualities in which they can actually operate very successfully the whole devotional and Vedic and Pancharatrik systems and get the maximum benefit out of it. Because for them, it's their life. They're born into it. They're conceived in it. Second generation is, as best we can, we conceive them in it. And us, that's another story. We won't get into that. Yeah. And here, with the permission of the teacher, then one gets married. It's saying here, having bathed and with the permission of the teacher, then he, according to the rules, performs some bartender, the graduation ceremony. Then, a twice-born man shall marry a wife of equal caste who is endowed with auspicious bodily marks. So auspicious means for these, the particular... Then, 5, says, a damsel who is neither a sapinda on the mother's side, nor belongs to the same family on the father's side, is recommended to twice-born men for wedlock and conjugal union. Says, in connecting himself with a wife, let him carefully avoid the 10 following families, be they ever so great or rich in kine, horses, sheep, grain, or other property. So there's a very carefulness, how do you say? That we do not, how do you say? It means you have the intermingling of the families, because you have the common genes, and so in other words, with the blood relations and all that, then there's a whole technical thing here. Not in here. Let's see. Daughter of a paternal aunt. Daughter of a paternal aunt or of a paternal father's sister's descendants are forgiven. Forbidden. So that means niece and this is on the mother's side. But it says here also on the father's. Paternal grandfather's sister's descendants. Paternal grandfather's father's. Father's father, sister, those descendants are also forbidden. So these are certain elements of, I don't know them so well, but it basically means it's just like the common thing in the West, it's just no first cousins. like that. That generally does. But here it's also pointing out that on the father's side, his father's sister, those ones, even though they're paternal grandfather's sisters, yeah. That also is not recommended. Like that. I'm not exactly sure. We got grandparents, father's sister. That's father's, that means the great grandfather's qualities that go into the sister. And then those would come down into her son. And then, I don't know. It's interesting because it always switches. The father's qualities go to the daughter, the daughter's to the they switch like this. Yeah, to the father's to the daughter, the wife's to the son. So then these keep switching, and then that creates certain things. So certain ones you can mix, certain ones you can't. So basically, if you avoid the thing of first cousins, then it works. These are only very technical things outside that, but generally we're not worried about big joint families and stuff like that. You know. So these families in which they neglect sacred rites, which the Veda has not studied. Those who are very rough in conduct and who are always very, generally very sickly or very heavy diseases, it's generally one has to be careful because many times those diseases will come into the children. Because sometimes they transfer to the children or they're inherent in the family. So it just says one should be very careful to see that. In other words, the whole idea is the children are the ones. See, husband and wife, even you marry a first cousin, the problem is there's not going to be no problem for the husband and wife. The problem is going to be for the children. So the grihastha life is for the purpose of creating children. Therefore, those considerations must be there. So if the family has some very heavy diseases or very rough nature or they're uncultured, like that, then these qualities will come through into the children. So it's generally one should be very, very careful to see these things. And naturally, as devotees, then these are the cultural aspects we don't have to worry about because basically first generation, no one's necessarily coming from a family where the Veda was studied and all the proper sacred rites are being, followed. So that aspect, we know as devotees, then that's not there. But still one should also just be very careful that the physical difficulties aren't going to be there. Because if one is interested in children, one has to see what the children will end up with. So they don't become overly weakened. Okay, then... Yeah. here, the different rites. Text 20. Now listen to the brief description of the following eight marriage rites used by the four castes, Varnas, which partly secure benefits and partly produce evil both in this life and after death. They are the rite of Brahman, Brahma, that of the gods, Daiva, that of the rishis, Arsha, that of the Prajapatis, Prajapatya, that of the Asuras, Asura, that of the Gandharvas, Gandharva, that of the Rakshasas, Rakshasa, and that of the Paisachas. So you have that Brahma, Daiva, Arsha, Prajapatya, Asura, Gandharva, Rakshasa, and Paisacha, which is lawful for each caste, Varna, and which are the virtues or faults of each rite. All this I will declare to you, as well as their good and evil results with respect to the offspring. One may know that the first six, according to the order followed above, are lawful for a Brahmana. That means, okay, according to Brahma, the demigods, the rishis, Prajapatis, means the Rakshasas and Paisachas are avoided by Brahmins. Then the last four for Kshatriyas, Prajapatya, Gandharva, Asura, Gandharva, Rakshasa, and Paisach. And the same four, excepting the Rakshasa rite, for a Vaishya and a Shudra. So basically, in all these things we follow, as we discussed before, as devotees, in our culture is that of that is according to, because of the Vaishnav culture is the culture of Brahmins, realized Brahmins. Therefore, we always follow the Brahminical aspects, like that. The Kshatriya aspects are, one can do, but then one has to be, one actually has to have the Kshatriya qualities. It can't be just we fancy ourselves, that we actually have to have. So generally the the devotees will stick to the Brahminical culture, especially those who are specifically interested in going back to Godhead very quickly. So this goes into a whole nother area, and we're already at the end of the time. So if there are any questions on any of this up to now, it means leaving this what we just mentioned about the eight kinds of marriages. Anything before that? Yes.
Maharaj, talking about the training of children from a young age. Mm. I'm not sure about so many other communities, devoted communities around the world, but in the community I live in New Zealand, it seems it can be like a predominant sort of philosophy there that if we, actually I shouldn't say predominant, but there's definitely elements of a philosophy there that if we repress the children and enforce so much kind of Vedic type, understanding, and then at a later age they'll feel repressed, and there'll be this repressed Gurukuli syndrome, and they'll want to go out into the world and enjoy. So better that we let them read Karami books from a young age, go to the movies, eat chocolate, give them all these alternatives, let them go to Karami school, and this will be better in the long run.
Do they let them smoke cigarettes? Take drugs? I mean, in America sometimes the blacks have sex at 8. Do they allow that?
No.
So therefore, if you check carefully, what are those things they're allowing? These are things that the parents don't think are bad. In other words, a parent will naturally always give the best to the child. So those things that they think are of value or use, or at least not bad, only those things they'll allow them to do. So if you look at it, these are just common things of the Western Christian culture that are not considered, they're very nice, wholesome. But have the parents ever read some of these books? They should sit down and read some of these modern science fiction books that the kids read. I mean, it's just, there's a lot of sex in it. a lot of sex. And it's not, and it's not of any character. You know, it's not, it's not even of the, you know, the go back into your, you know, fairy tale romantic. At least there, there was some emotional exchange. At least there was some idea of ideal relationships and proper, how you say, dealings amongst people. But these modern books, it's just, you know, it's just skin. So they have to really think, that's one aspect. So that's just the, how you say, the natural reaction. The actual, you know, my answer would be, is, now this is coming from, the point is they've seen children go through the Gurukul, and then they've come out and they feel they didn't get a good result. So therefore we should just let them do whatever they like and then they'll come out nice. So now, and that's all right, is if, as long as that is why the Gurukuli syndrome manifests. But then maybe, I mean, if we had discussed and seen what are the relationships going on in the Gurukul that are described here in the Vedic culture, because they'll use the term Vedic, so then were those present? Did the students have natural, firm affection and respect for the teachers? Did the teachers have that for the students? Were the teachers giving to the children what they thought best and what they followed themselves? Was the teachers dealing with individuals? Or there was just a program that everybody had to follow? Was the individual consideration there? Right? Means the real individual of the student starts coming out in the teen years. We have maybe like 30 schools or more in the movement. How many deal with children above 12? Many? No. So therefore we can understand that that there may have been a lack of understanding how to deal with the individuals and how to imbibe in them a set of values. Because the whole purpose of the Vedic education is, if you stay in the house, you're going to take things for granted. You know? You know, you make a mess, your mother cleans up the mess. You know, you go in at certain times of the day, and generally then there's something to eat. And even in between times, and there's, you know, this, you know, cookie jar, a bowl of fruit, or there's the refrigerator. And, you know, you can come in and you can sleep. You know, you lose something, you know, your father buys you a new one. And, you know, it just happens. It's like automatic pilot. So then the problem happens is that child in that environment, his brain is also an automatic pilot. So academically he may learn, but culturally not so much is necessarily gained. So unless the child is made aware of what is of value and made to think for himself, he's not going to accept that. It means the first aspect of education is shravana, you hear. The second aspect, after you've heard and you know the subject matter, is you have to be trained how to contemplate, understand, and follow. Why you're following, why it's done. Then, by practice of that, then you come to the platform of realizing what it is, and then you value it. And once you value it, you do it. So if the children didn't come to the point of valuing the Krishna conscious culture, that means the system didn't make them contemplative. So by keeping them but we see that if you stay at the home, one has a tendency not to actually contemplate things. So when one goes away to the school, then one has a tendency to contemplate. Only girls actually in the house can be observative. Boys in the house, they're blobs, they're slobs. You ask any woman, any mother. Girls 9 years old, they can chant 16 rounds, they can know what to be done, what not to be done, they're clean, orderly, tidy. Right? You ever see a slovenly, slobby, you know, little girl? Their braids are perfect, their dress is perfect. You know, their mother may have dressed them up, but it stays that way the whole day. But you can dress up the boy, you let him out the door, and before he's walked down the step, he looks like a monster. Right? So therefore, the boy, unless he's in an environment that makes him think that it's not coming for granted, only then he becomes, he develops. Only then he prospers. So therefore, the Vedic culture arranged that those who were interested seriously in spiritual life went to the Gurukul. So they became observant, and they actually valued these things for themselves. They're chanting Hare Krishna because they want to chant Hare Krishna. They've been taught to chant, but they do it because they want to chant. So that's the element that's important. So now, if they didn't come to that point of value, then we have to check what was the system. So we can't say, well, the system's no good, throw it out, because the home doesn't work either. You know? Home doesn't work either. Right? When Prabhupada came to America and all these people were joining him, they were all persons who were comfortably situated in their homes and perfectly satisfied just living in their home environment. Or they were people who were frustrated with that and gone out in search of something more than just the rut of family life. Right? So they were pranipata, they were interested in knowledge. So when they met Prabhupada, then they took it up. Right? So that's a very important element. You have to create interest. You have to create thoughtfulness. You have to create value in the student. And that can only come if the teachers are like that. So that element has to be seen. And one can say, well, there's no teachers like that. So then why is anybody having children? As we discussed before, who, before having the child, is not, who is cultured, doesn't think, how is this child going to be raised? Right? I just would like to have a child. How he'll be raised, what he'll do, what his future will be, what can I say? Now, is that not selfish or what? So then, if it's not that, why it's not created? Why mature devotees are not found for this? Right? But in those days that they're talking about, now, who was put into the Gurukul as a teacher? Right? Someone who, one, couldn't manage a temple. That's first. Second, could not do Sankirtan. Right? Third, was not good as, you know, a secretary, a temple commander, or head of some other department in the temple. You know, head pujari. Means they were better than the guy washing pots, but they didn't know what was going on, and they seemed to be a little educated. So what do? You stick them in the Gurukul. So then, is that how the Vedic culture would choose their teachers? No. They would take the most qualified people, make them teachers. Then you get the most qualified students. You go to any good educational institution in the world, the better the institution, the better the teachers. You know, you go to Harvard or Oxford or Cambridge. Now, they just have guys that couldn't make it anywhere, or they have their best teachers. Right? Understand? So that element is very, very important. So then we have to look at what created that, not just off the top of our head, because they weren't allowed to read Kwami books, therefore they became like they became. No, because they were regulated to some degree, therefore they're only reading a few Kwami books, smoking a little dope, and hanging out with other Gurukuli kids. They're not off, you know, doing all kinds of crazy things like other kids are doing. Restriction. They can just do anything in the house. You know? Can the kid just invite all his friends over and in his bedroom sit and yell and scream all night and party? Will the parents allow it? No. So then why restrict? It means if you're going to take the philosophy, take it. I mean, there's a school in England called Summerhill. Whatever they want, they can do it. They want to burn down the classroom, they can burn it down. No one will stop them. They may come to them and explain to them the use of the building and how if they burn it down, then, you know, there won't be any classes and all that. But if you really want to burn it down, they'll let them burn it down. They actually live the philosophy they say. You know? Like that. But we can't just, we only restrict on the, you know, good, upstanding, moral Christian side. And then kind of like, you know, ignore or throw out the Vedic because it's not practical. So like that. Those parents, when they were kids, they read karmic things, they did this and that. All it is that they're bringing their kids up in the 50s and 60s, that's all. But they're not allowing their kids to grow up in the 90s. You know? I mean, what would they say? Would they restrict? They find out the 12-year-old kid's taking crack? Or he makes his money by going down and selling crack down in the local, you know, goes down to, you know, hops on his, you know, chop chrome Harley and rides down to, Auckland, you know, center and sells crack to, make his petrol money. Would they allow that? Good chance they just tell him, "I'm sorry, hit the road, get out of here." So therefore, we really have to look at it. It's very nice. It sounds very nice, but what's the reality of what is being said? That has to be studied, because Vedic culture means knowledge, and we have to study and actually understand what is being said and understood. Otherwise, it sounds good, but they can read any Karmi magazine. I mean Playboy magazines are also Karmi magazines. Can they look at those? No. So then, but why restrict? Any 12-year-old boy would like to check out the Playboy magazine. But why restrict? Can he watch porno movies? Why restrict? Because what is the bottom line? It's not moral. Right? That is the bottom line. If it's against, it's not moral. Taking drugs, smoking, all these illicit activities, they're not moral. So therefore, that's as low as we can go. But they won't let them go below that. So they're restricting them just to don't drop below the moral platform. And Prabhupada is trying to get it, don't drop below the religious platform. Right? Religion means social codes. Moral just means, you know, just there's a little bit of basic character, like that. So it's just a matter of where you place your bottom line, because restriction is there. They can say we don't restrict, but they are restricting. Very much they are restricting their children. But it's just at what point of cutoff of consciousness they restrict it. So restriction in the West means pranamoy. But restriction in the Vedic culture means manamoy. Because as we discussed some days before, the restriction creates relationships. If you don't restrict, there's no relationship. Because there must be give and take. I don't restrict myself, I can't have a relationship with someone else properly. Means, can I be a proper son and have a relationship with my mother if I just call her bad mouth my mother and say all kinds of nasty things and whack her on the back and, you know, make jokes about her? Can I do that? No, so I have to restrict myself. I may not appreciate what my mother just did, But can I, if I want to maintain the relationship of mother and child, can I speak like that? No. So I have to restrict. Mother has so many things she'd like to do. But instead of doing that, she's picking up your socks and cooking and, you know, doing all these funny things. So she's restricting what she'd like to do this. And therefore it creates a relationship. So this is actually just another form of Kali Raja's entrance. He knows you break down restriction, you break down relationships. You break down relationships, people can't work together. People can't work together, you cannot have Samkirtan. Samkirtan means congregational chanting. Congregational chanting is Yuga Dharma. So if you make it so nobody can work with anybody else, no one trusts anyone else, no one respects anyone else, no one wants to follow authority, then you've just wiped out the Samkirtan mission. And who in this age can just sit down and chant three lakhs of names on their own and just become Babaji's? You know, okay, you know, I'm not dealing with this, you know, institution and all this. I'm just going to sit down and chant Hare Krishna all day and go back to Godhead. Who's there? Let them step forward. So without the support of the Samkirtan mission, how's it going to happen? Therefore, Kali Raj just has to break down relationships. How does he break it down? Break down restriction. Why do joint families not function nowadays? They're still there, but I mean, so why are they on the decrease? Because you're restricted. Right? You have 10 brothers living in one monster house and all that. You know, with basically a common kitchen, with the grandparents like running the whole show. Then you don't have that much things of what you can do. So therefore, they want to be independent. So therefore, you know, the birth of the nuclear family. But then in the nuclear family, now even husband wants to do his thing, wife her thing, son his thing, daughter her thing. Then what happens to the nuclear family? It doesn't exist. Nuclear family was something, you know, the wonderful nuclear family, something of the 50s and early 60s. You know, nowadays, where's the nuclear family? You know? Right. Have to leave? Huh? Okay. Well, we'll end now, anyway. So, we have to see that we have to actually look at what's there. Otherwise, we're not necessarily going to get a result that we want. You know? Means we have to actually deeply have to look at it. Culture and social structure is something very highly developed. It's beyond morality. It's called religious principles. Morality is called sub-religious principles. So Prabhupada is trying to introduce us to religious principles. Religious principles include sub-religious. Just as emotions include senses. Right? The emotional exchange between the mother and the child, the mother wants to do something for the child. She feeds the child. But her cooking and serving the child is all working on the emotional platform. But the senses of the child are being taken care of. Right? And the child is enjoying not so much just necessarily the taste, but mother has cooked it, mother is serving it. You know, mother has cooked it because of her affection. So that's what's being appreciated. The taste, how long you appreciate that? Right? The taste of eating, what, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, finished. But mother is in the kitchen cooking, or she's gone to the market, or made so many preparations. It may be days that this emotional experience of doing something for the child is there. Right? While serving, afterwards she knows he's satisfied. That doesn't leave. That the sense lasted for 15 minutes. 10 minutes. Understand? So if you have the emotional, you have the senses. So if you have dharma, you have morality. the higher includes the lower. Right? Each rasa as you go up includes the lower one. So each level of consciousness as you go up includes the lower one. So like that, is you train the children in religious principles, then they'll automatically be moral. You try to treat them in morality, they may or may not be moral. Right? I mean, for a devotee, is it hard to follow the Ten Commandments? No, because they're working on a higher platform. But amongst Christians, how many are following the Ten Commandments? You know, just general average. Difficult. So like that, one has to actually see what is actually happening. You know? The children don't, means one generation doesn't take, the second generation doesn't follow the first generation, means the first generation was not able to transfer the values. Right? So then one has to actually look at it, what went wrong that the values weren't transferred, and then try to figure out how to correct that. That is the real thing. It's not a matter of, you know, more liberal, more strict. Right? Like that. That's not there. The point is actual dealings in the values. You know, I would, just my own experience, I probably gained more as far as culture, as far as, you know, emotional dealings with others, relationships, depth of being able to relate with other people, from my father, who was more strict, than from my mother, who was more liberal. Like that. And I respect my father for his dealings, his discipline, and that. I don't respect my mother for the way she disciplined. Because my father was disciplining on rules and regulations. Right? This is the rule, this is the culture. You break that, it's a disturbance. So therefore, there must be some method of correcting that. Well, the mother is that you don't behave properly, she becomes frustrated and angry and emotional, and then she tries to discipline in that atmosphere. Nothing's gained. Neither discipline nor respect. For the father who is dealing with, you know, this is the way it should be done, and he would explain it and discuss it, then the values were transferred. Like that. You know? So these essential things are transferred in that way. Respect of authority, natural religious feelings, you know, dealings with others, you know, exchange with others. These are all the things you're supposed to learn from the parents before they even get to the Gurukul. You know, you can also, if you really want to, you know, open a Pandora's box, then you can find out from the, you know, teachers who knew, what were the children like when they went to the Gurukul? Were they angels when they went to the Gurukul and then the Gurukul itself turned them into demons? Or they came undisciplined and wild? And then the school, being untrained itself, didn't know how to discipline and train them, so it just worsened the situation. You know, frying pan into fire. Right? Maybe they may have been innocent and just kids, but did they have, you know, what was the position? Many may have had, and by the bad teachers that may have been removed, but many didn't. Many of the kids themselves were crazy. Crazy meaning not clinically, just means wild. You know? Coming from broken families and this and that. You know, I once saw a... Yeah. So it's a very deep subject. It has to be very, very carefully looked at. If we want to actually solve, we just want to make a superficial quick fix solution, then these kind of slogans are great. But if you actually want to solve a cultural problem, then you have to look at what is culture. How is culture imbibed? How is it taught? You know, what is the source of culture? It means what is the standard of culture? Where do we take it from? And we go down to the, you know, the 5 and 10 and pick one up, you know, or the Kmart, or, you know, we send away for it and, you know, from a, what do you call it? Sears and Roebuck, or we just collect enough Cracker Jack's lids, you know, box lids, and send away and get it, or how, where does it come from? What is the standards? Then, based on that, then you can actually establish culture. But you have to first know what it is, right? If I want to go to the market to buy a potato, I first have to know what a potato is. I have to know what a market is. You know, if I go down to the second-hand car shop, I probably won't find a potato, you know. Maybe in one of the exhaust pipes, but otherwise I'm not going to find a potato. Right? So I have to know what I'm looking for and where to find it. Then we can be successful. Like that. Okay, I think we should end here. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.